Let's turn together to Genesis chapter 29. Something significant happened in the last chapter, didn't it? Jacob was fleeing from his family and from his brother's anger and going away from the promised land to find his mother's family in Padan Aram. And on that journey, God visited him and renewed his covenant with Jacob, giving him a vision of a ladder stretching from heaven to earth, and that the connection between God and man established by God himself. And we saw that Jesus Christ used that vision to describe himself, that he is that connection between God and man, that in Jesus Christ that we meet with God. And so Jacob goes from there, and we pick up the narration of what happens to Jacob then in the beginning of chapter 29. So Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. And he looked and saw a well in the field. Behold, there were three flocks of sheep lying by it, for out of that well they watered the flocks. A large stone was on the well's mouth. Now all the flocks would be gathered there. They would roll the stone from the well's mouth, water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place on the well's mouth. And Jacob said to them, "My brethren, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." And then he said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said to him, "We know him." So he said to them, "Is he well?" And they said, "He is well. And look, his daughter Rachel is coming with the sheep." Then he said, "Look, it is still high day. It's not time for the cattle to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go and feed them." But they said, "We cannot until the flocks are gathered together and they have rolled the stone from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep." Now, while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And it came to pass, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. So she ran and told her father. Then it came to pass, when Laban heard the report about Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. So he told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, "Surely you are my bone and my flesh." And he stayed with him for a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, "Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what should your wages be?" Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, "I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter." And Laban said, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love that he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, and I may go into her." And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob. And he went in to her. And Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me?" Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me? And Laban said, it must not be done so in our country, to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one also for the service which you will serve me with still another 7 years. Then Jacob did so, and fulfilled her week. So he gave him his daughter Rachel, his wife also. And Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maid. Then Jacob also went in to Rachel. And he also loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban still another 7 years. We're now following Jacob as he goes to his mother's people. But the Jacob of Genesis 29 is a different Jacob than what we discovered in chapters 27 and 28. This Jacob has been to Bethel, the house of God. This Jacob has met with the God of the covenant. And the living God has come to him and has promised to be with him, to be a God to him and to his children after him. We can see that God has strengthened Jacob's faith, that he has breathed into him a different spirit, so that the journey that he sets out on in the beginning of chapter 29 is very different than the journey that he was taking in chapter 28. Physically speaking, it's the very same path. The map has not changed, but the man has. In leaving his parents' household, Jacob was fleeing for his life. He had stolen a blessing from his brother, and Esau had sworn to kill him. And so Jacob was fleeing from that. But now, Jacob knows that the God of the promise has said that he would be with him. If this God has promised to be his God to him and to his children after him. So verse 1, interestingly, it says literally that he lifted up his feet. It's lost a little bit in the translation when it says that he just continued on his journey. But it literally says he lifted up his feet. I think you can see the difference there of someone who might be plodding along, fearful and dejected. Your children might imagine how you go to your room when you're parents have sent you there. If you're being disciplined, you might go up the steps to your room kind of like this. Now your feet heavy or light as you go to your room? They are heavy because you know that something is wrong. But when forgiveness comes and you're invited back downstairs out of your room, your feet literally fly down the steps. Your feet are light, aren't they? Jacob's feet were lifted up as he went upon his journey. He knew that God had promised to be with him and to provide for him. As the narrative follows, I'd like you to pay close attention to the changes that we see that have come over Jacob. And I also want you to see how those changes are tested. The theme of this passage really flows from chapter 28 and the promises that God has given to Jacob. God has said that he would be faithful to Jacob wherever he went. And that is immediately tested in chapter 29. For those of you who are taking notes, this is the meaning of this passage, or this is the main theme of this passage, that God is faithful to Jacob in blessing and in trial. God is faithful to Jacob in blessing and in trial. Now, I'd have you see that in these three ways. First of all, God's providence. Second, in Jacob's love. And third, in Jacob deceived. And in all of this, I would have you apply it to your own life to see how God is faithful to you in blessing and in trial. We begin with God's providence. God's care is immediately seen, isn't it, in Jacob's life? God providentially led him to the very place that he was looking for. He goes to the place where the flocks of sheep are being watered, and he inquires of the shepherds that are there. Now, Jacob would have been traveling without MapQuest.com, and so he did not have his printed out map from the internet, which would show him the exact location of Laban's household. And you'll have to remember that as shepherd people were a nomadic people, so the internet wasn't probably updated enough for them to find Laban anyway. So he's traveling along, and he's relying upon word of mouth. He's relying upon the directions that he receives from the people that he meets. The internet was a lot slower then. It was word of mouth. And he comes to this well in the country where he was looking, and he asked the people there, the shepherds that were there, and he asked them where they came from. And he knows that he is getting close because they're from Haran. This is where Laban lives, and so he asks if they're acquainted with Laban. Lo and behold, they say, not only do they know him, but here comes his daughter, Rachel, even now, to water his sheep. Now, if we don't believe in God, we would say, what a neat coincidence. Isn't that interesting that he happens upon the very place where his cousin is coming to water the sheep? But we believe in the God of the Bible. We believe that the God of the Bible directs our every step. We believe that the God knows and numbers the hair on our head. That he cares, as Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, he cares even if a sparrow falls to the ground. So that every detail of our lives is wrapped up in God's all-seeing, all-knowing care. And here's just a very practical example of that, of God's providentially directing Jacob's steps so that he went to exactly the place where he needed to be. The Lord was immediately putting into effect the promise that he had given to Jacob, that he would go with him and he would provide for him. We just immediately put that into our own situation because we stand in a world that is often swirling about with lots of decisions and lots of directions that confront us. Decisions as grand as, what will I do with my life? Where will I go to school? What will I study? Down to the very mundane decisions of what will we eat today, and what will I study, what will I do? Very mundane questions. And all of those questions are wrapped up in God's all-knowing and all-seeing care. And God has promised that he would oversee even those intricate windings of our life, from the greatest to the most mundane, to direct our paths. I pray that the providence with which God governed Jacob's steps would be a comfort to you in the day-to-day decisions that you make, both the big and the small decisions, to know that God is faithful in blessing and trial. Now, Jacob seems to have been awakened to this God of the promise. He seems to be awakened to the reality of God's hand upon his life. Look at what he does when he finds out where he is and who this is that's coming to the well. He is immediately filled with joyful appreciation. He rushes over to uncover the well so that Rachel and the other shepherds could water their flocks, and then that he's the one that labors to provide for Rachel and for the sheep that she has brought. Now, over the many miles of Jacob's journey, I think that he had plenty of time to meditate on this God of the covenant and what he had done for him. And I can just imagine him looking back on what has gone before in his life, and looking back in the light of Bethel at the way he had treated his brother and his family, the way he had deceived them, the way he had seemingly even been unconscious to this God of the covenant. But now, as he moves forward, he is aware of the hand of God upon him and is filled with great joy and appreciation, so that he marvels at God's goodness to him. And that's shown then in his dealings with Rachel. It says that he wept at finding her, and he kissed her. And this would be the greeting of a kiss, not a romantic kiss, but the greeting of a family coming together at this point. We know that because Laban comes and kisses Jacob next, and that was not a romantic kiss either. So here is someone who is just overflowing with joy at God's providence. The Lord was directing Jacob's path, and the Jacob that's been to Bethel is now aware of that and sees the faithfulness of God in providing for him. What develops next is actually a very touching love story, a relationship that God has ordained as provision for Jacob. And that's where we turn next, to see God's provision in Jacob's love. It is interesting that with the relationships that have come to this point in the book of Genesis, that this one is the first that highlights the love between a husband and wife. It's not that there wasn't any love between the marriages that have gone beforehand, but this marriage highlights the emotional connection between Jacob and Rachel. We find that in Jacob's words to Laban after he had lived with him for a month. He says to Rachel's father, "I love Rachel." And he's proposing that he would have Rachel's hand in marriage and has proposed an arrangement for that. "I love Rachel." Now, I can see some of the fathers sitting up a little straighter and tensing up at this. "Just a month? And you love my daughter? You're crazy. Just get out of here." But here's another key event that demonstrates the change that's come over Jacob. You would expect that to get the hand of Rachel, that Jacob, the old Jacob, would trick Laban. That's what he did to Esau and to his very own father to get a blessing. Now, to get the woman that he loves, surely the old Jacob would go behind Laban's back and maybe even seduce Rachel and run off with her. But that's not what Jacob did. In full view of her father, and with all honor, Jacob declares his heart and his intention. And he proposed that he worked 7 years for Rachel's hand. Just a side note, this would have been customary in many Eastern cultures that a gift or a dowry be given to the bride's family, a way of honoring the gift that is received by the groom, symbolically replacing the daughter. So it wasn't this wasn't any slavery or any purchase of a woman that's taking place here. It was part of their culture to honor the family. And Jacob had fled from his parents' home. He had taken very little with him. And he stands in a position now with very little to offer as a dowry for Rachel's hand. But what he did have was his time and his labor. God had promised to prosper his work, to be with him. And so moving out on that promise, Jacob pledges to work 7 years for Rachel's hand in marriage. And now, the father in me sits up and pays attention. Here's a man who is not just infatuated with my daughter, has not just been overcome with her beauty, but is demonstrating very visibly and in very concrete forms with commitment of love to provide for my daughter. Now, in saying that, I'm distinguishing between types of love, and it's right for us to do that. On the one hand, we have what's often called infatuation between a man and woman. It can be instantaneous, and it can be fleeting. It's usually motivated by a physical or emotional attraction. On the other hand, we have the enduring, self-sacrificing love between a husband and wife. It's described as a love that is a lasting decision. And it involves the will to love another person and the commitment to belong to them for life. And it's right for us to distinguish between those two types of love. And especially in a day and age when the physical type of love is the only type of love that is portrayed to us in our culture. Let me take one step further, because a note of clarification is in order. I don't mean you to think that those two loves are mutually exclusive. We don't deny the physical aspects of humanity. God has created us as living, breathing, thinking, emotional, spiritual beings. Some have denied the goodness of physical love, and it's led them to lead a celibate life, having no husband or wife, having no physical relations between husband and wife. Those communities eventually die off for obvious reasons, but they have approached the physical world as somehow evil. But God has created us as we are, as physical beings. So we approve of physical love and see the boundaries with which the Creator God has given for it, that it's to be expressed only between a husband and wife. I say all that to say it's okay to be attracted to the one you love and to enjoy the good gift that God has given to us. Now, attraction isn't enough. If your reason for considering marriage is because she looks good or he looks great, then you don't understand the commitment of marriage or the sweetness of biblical covenant love. The homeschoolers group had a fun play that they did a couple of years ago called Cyrano de Bergerac. And the heroine falls in love with a musketeer who's good-looking, but finds that the love that she really had was expressed as her soul met the soul of someone who was speaking to her in letters. The hero, Cyrano de Bergerac, who thinks of himself as an ugly individual and no way being able to attain to this physical beauty. But the two fall in love unbeknownst, not knowing who it exactly is. I mention that just to see the connection, the heart connection that is made between the two that goes beyond the physical attraction. See, our culture portrays physical love as the only love and that as the end of all other loves. But in fact, attraction is not the end of the story, but only the beginning of it. It's just the beginning of the beautiful story that a husband and wife will write together. At the end of the day, it's the covenant love, the decision to live with and to love another individual, that provides the basis for this type of marriage that Jacob and Rachel have. And Jacob provides us an example of this commitment to love. It's apparent that he is attracted to a woman of great beauty. But he's not just attracted in a physical way, but he acts to love his wife, or to love his potential wife. Because of his love for Rachel, Jacob is willing to act the part of a husband. He proposed to serve Laban for 7 years for Rachel. 7 years. Can you imagine waiting 7 years for your spouse? You have to remember that Isaac now is 77 years old. He's already waited quite a while to be provided with a wife. Again, I see a difference between the old Jacob and the new Jacob here. Here he is acting as a husband, committing to provide for the one he is espoused to. And guess what? It says that those years were like days to Jacob because of his love for Rachel. Like I say, this is a beautiful romance that is described between Jacob and Rachel. It's beautiful in another connection, because God takes the love of Jacob and Rachel and his commitment to serve for her, and he uses that as an example of his love for the church. This afternoon, look at the 12th chapter of Hosea. I'm going to read just two verses from there. Verses 12 and 13, God is speaking to a people who are rebellious, a people who are being judged and punished for their acting like a prostitute, is what Hosea is describing. And God is expressing his love, his faithful love. Hosea says, Jacob fled to the country of Syria. Israel served for a spouse, and for a wife she tended sheep. By a prophet, the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt, and by a prophet he was preserved. See, God was comparing Jacob's service for Rachel to his own faithful love to deliver the children of Israel out of bondage in Egypt. It's to describe ultimately his faithful love in Jesus Christ. Here we leap right into the New Testament and the imagery that the New Testament authors describe the love of Jesus Christ for his bride. So that Jesus is the groom and you, God's people, are his wife. And the imagery is picked up in Ephesians, where it says that we are clothed in the righteous robes of Christ. And it's an example that's given to us as husbands and wives to see how Jesus has loved the church. And then I read from that great vision in Revelation chapter 19 to see the wedding feast of the Lamb. So God picks up this love that Jacob has for Rachel, and he portrays it as his love for his people, his love for you, the church. And this is God's provision for Jacob and for us, the good things of this life, marriage itself. Surely this is one of the greatest gifts that God gives. It's the marriage like Jacob and Rachel. And they lived happily ever after. And they rode off to their castle in the clouds. That's the way a fairy tale would end, but this is no fairy tale. This is the history of God's people. And God had a further purpose for Jacob. He would learn by God's hand that God was faithful in blessing and in trial. Jacob wakes up on the morning after his wedding, and the smile on his face is erased with the shock of realization that the woman lying beside him is not Rachel, whom he loves, but is in fact her sister, Leah. "What is this you have done to me? What is..." Well, God is teaching Jacob in all situations that he is with him. Let me back up and trace the steps to that wedding morning, because Jacob had a lesson in humility first. A month after Jacob arrived, Laban came to him and proposed to pay him some wages for his services. Now, on first reading, that seems to be a very noble and gracious offer. Laban seems to be treating him well by offering to pay him for his time there. But peel away the initial layer of the smiling offer and look at Jacob. Jacob, as Isaac's son, was master of his house. He was an heir of his father, and the primary heir, for that matter. But in Laban's household, he is now reduced to a hired hand. Time will reveal the type of hired hand that he was. After 20 years of service, Jacob says, "I have served you faithfully, and you have changed my wages 10 times. And that doesn't mean that he got a raise 10 times over those 20 years. We might think that would be pretty bad in and of itself. But what Laban was doing was trying to take advantage of Jacob. We'll see this in the coming weeks, that Jacob would make an Laban would make an arrangement with Jacob, and as Jacob got the better hand in that arrangement, Jacob would say, "Oh, wait, what was I thinking of? Let's try this." And we'll see how that has played out. And Laban had a mercenary heart, and he saw Jacob as one that he was going to get more out of than he gave. And that comes through especially in the marriage arrangement. It comes up first when the 7 years are over, and Jacob has to remind Laban that it's time for him to keep his bargain. "Give me my wife. My time is completed." But to top it all off, Laban deceived Jacob by giving him the older daughter Leah instead of Rachel. And in the darkness of that wedding night, Jacob went in with Leah instead of Rachel. And in the morning, he was right to be shocked. He was right to be shocked at what Laban had done to him. Laban, though, reasons that it was against their practice to give a younger daughter away in marriage before the older was married. So Laban says, "I'm not really withholding Rachel. You can have her too. Just complete your time with Leah, your week with her, and then I will give you Rachel as I had promised, if you will also work for me another 7 years." Now, we aren't exactly sure why Jacob agreed to this. He could have reasoned with Laban that such a marriage was illegal and immoral, that he was taking multiple wives to himself. But in order to win Rachel's hand, the woman that he loved, he saw Laban as the key. And if Laban said, first you got to take Leah, and then you can have Rachel, you can see how Jacob felt himself between a rock and a hard place, and not knowing what to do. He said he could have argued that Leah was not the covenanted wife that he had proposed, and that that marriage implies the mutual consent, and that he was deceived in this. It was not a mutual agreement. But in the end, Jacob takes both Leah and Rachel as his wives. And here it's hard to miss the irony of this situation. I like the way Dr. Boyce speaks of this. He points out the following ironies: that Jacob had been told how Esau would serve him, but first he had had to learn how to serve Laban. But Jacob was forced to learn the right of the firstborn, that it must be respected, something he had been unwilling to do in the case of his own brother Esau. Jacob was deceived by Rachel's father, just as he had been instrumental in deceiving his father. He was deceived by Leah in Rachel's clothes, while he had deceived his father in Esau's clothes. The deceiver is now the deceived one. Dr. Boyce says that he reaped as he had sown, and even became a part of the pattern of deceit that was to mar his long life and family relations. Well, in this, God brought home a valuable lesson. Jacob before had reasoned that the ends justified the means, and so he tricked his brother and his father to get some good thing that he perceived. And now Laban's reasoning is similar. The good end was that customarily the older daughter would be given in marriage first. And it appears that Rachel was more desirable than Leah. So maybe they were thinking this is their only chance to get a husband for Leah. So the ends justify the means. Jacob had the tables turned on him. And the shock of his face and his voice and the realization in that morning reminds me of Isaac's shock and realization when he realizes the deception that has been pulled on him. And here is Jacob waking up in the same bed, waking up to the realization of what he had done. He learned the hard way about his own actions, and about the pain and sorrow that had been brought to his family. And he learned in a very graphic way that God's good ends must be sought through godly means. He learned that his actions did indeed have consequences. You see, God forgives our sins, but sometimes he allows the consequences of our actions to follow after us, to warn us and to teach us. Well, that brings us full circle, because in Jacob's case, he had learned that God was faithful in blessing, and now he has learned that God is faithful in trial. He had seen the richness of God in mercy, that God had promised to be his God to him and to his children after him. And now, when it seems like all of that is being wiped away, Jacob could say, where is this God of the promise? Does it mean that God has deserted Jacob? Quite the contrary. As Jacob learned, actions do have consequences, and God is faithful even in those to lead us along and to teach us. So we apply that to ourselves. We stand upon the promises that God gives us, a life-giving spirit. And because of that, it gives us motivation to live in a certain way, to follow after God in all types of situations. We understand that we are changed eternally in God's sight because of Jesus Christ. And that has an impact on how we live practically every day. And we learn that God is faithful in blessing and in trial, even as our own foolish and sinful actions come back to roost in our own life. God graciously withholds many of those consequences, many of the fruits that grow up from our foolishness and rebellion. Nevertheless, he does appoint some consequences to follow, to teach us, to cling to him. Does that mean that he has forsaken us? Hardly. He disciplines us as the son that he loves. And that discipline is never pleasant, as Hebrews says. But it comes from the hand of a God who loves us and who is directing us. So we understand that God has loved us with his perfect love, giving us his son as the price. We understand that he has raised us up, and he has clothed us in the spotless wedding robes of Jesus Christ. And we know that we are made partakers of the wedding supper of the Lamb. And that gives us the confidence to know, just as Jacob did, that God is faithful in blessing and in trial. May he be teaching you that as you face the wide variety of intricate decisions and wide variety of circumstances that you will meet this very day. From the large decisions of what will I do with my life down to the very mundane decisions and the mundane happenings. Please remember Jacob and remember that God is faithful. Oh Lord, as we reflect upon your goodness to Jacob and your hand upon him, we praise you that you are faithful, that you are faithful to us, that you have given your son as a price to redeem us, to purchase us by your love, that we might be that spotless bride. And God, thank you for loving us in a way that cleanses us from our sin and that teaches us to walk in a newness of life, to walk in holiness and a changed character. God, I pray that you would be breathing that into us, breathing that new life in Jesus Christ, so that we would walk in the purity of our justification and in the progress of our sanctification. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. We'll close by singing Psalm 140, Selection B. The deceiver deceived may have thought of and prayed words such as these, that the wicked desire would not be fulfilled. And he could also express that he knew that Jehovah would maintain the cause of those oppressed, that he would defend his children, that he would, that we would see the work of God in our lives. Let's stand and sing Psalm 140, Selection B.